KPTZ now joins the Board of County Commissioners' weekly meeting for this week's public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Courthouse.
Whenever we get the recording going?
We're on.
All right. Hello again. We're returning from recess and joined by our health officer, Dr. Locke, and the Department of Emergency Management Manager, Willie Bintz, for our weekly update. And we also welcome the listeners from KPTZ. And with that, I'm going to report my pass it off to you, Dr. Locke. Some disturbing numbers over the weekend. How are we looking?
Well, our case count continues to go up. We actually had what would now be our 38th case was reported to us yesterday. So we're still doing the investigation on that. And I've gotten a lot of questions sort of asking for more details about who is getting infected, how are we finding them, what kind of testing strategies we're using. I'd be glad to cover all of that. I think those are important questions, and I think I can answer them without giving away identifying information, which we never do. But I can certainly talk about them in general terms. First, just to kind of establish the big picture, we're now over 2.5 million cases have been diagnosed in the U.S., and more and more people, including the director of the CDC, is confirming what we've known for a long time, and that these confirmed cases are the tip of the iceberg. We now have pretty solid information through antibody testing that for every case we confirm, there are at least 10 other people who are actually infected, whose illness was mild enough or without symptoms whatsoever that they never came to attention. They never got tested. So that 2.5 million confirmed cases is probably more like 25 million Americans have now had COVID-19. This number internationally is much larger. There's over 10 million confirmed cases around the world, and over 500,000 deaths. In the U.S., our mortality count is now up to 128,000, and that's pretty staggering that over one in four worldwide deaths from COVID-19 are in the United States. As you might imagine, the international statistics, especially in the developing world, are not very accurate. But certainly, the United States, compared to other developing countries, especially compared to Europe, is we are not doing well at all. The other developing countries have largely brought this into control. The United States has not. There are three states right now where the infection is entering into this, what we always try to prevent, and that is the exponential growth phase of spread. And they're Arizona, Texas, and Florida. They're starting to see their ICUs reach capacity. And at this point, there's probably nothing they can do short of complete reversal and go back to a full lockdown that will prevent them from hitting this medical surge kind of wall. They have neighboring states that can probably take some of the surge, but these are states that are in big trouble, and their governors have not really acted aggressively yet to this. There are 32 states where coronavirus is increasing now. That's an increase from where it was last week, and unfortunately, Washington is now on that list. We were one of the stable states Now we're seeing, it's not dramatic, but it's a steady uptick in cases, mostly driven by outbreaks in eastern Washington, and especially Yakima and Benton and Franklin counties. Yakima is now being hit really hard, actually much worse than even Seattle and King County was at the worst of the first wave. There are some, there's 14 states that where things are still relatively stable, and there's seven actually that are success stories where they're seeing declining rates. And that's still where we want to be in this state. What's going on, what's driving this is mostly clusters. So outbreaks that are associated with nursing homes and food processing plants, prisons and jails, churches have been an outbreak point, bars, restaurants, and it all goes along with what we know about this, that indoor spread, and especially people who are indoors and who have prolonged contact with each other, that's one of the highest risk situations. Here on the peninsula, we're definitely seeing an increase. Clallam County is as well. I was told yesterday by Dr. Unthank that they're currently doing two outbreak investigations in Clallam County. I don't have any more details about that yet. But in Jefferson, as I mentioned, we're up to 38 cases. And that's essentially that eight of those have been over the month of June. We were at 30 at the end of May. And of those eight, half of them, four of them have been picked up through asymptomatic screening. So these are people who had COVID tests before having other procedures, surgery, dental procedures, hospitalization for other causes, and what is now becoming routine is we test these folks for COVID, and four of them tested positive. This is one of the most challenging groups to find, but we do want to find it because every time we find a case, it leads us potentially to other cases and to other contacts, and that's how we contain things. So four of the eight were from pre-procedure screening. Two of the eight were contacts of known cases. And that's also our system at work. When we identify someone with infection, we also identify everyone who might have been exposed to them. Yes?
So does that mean that they were discovered as asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic? As part of the contact tracing, you said you need to get a test, and it came back positive? Is that what you're saying?
These actually were people who were contacts of known cases and became symptomatic. But one of our new protocols is we actually now test all close contacts. We wait until a week after they've had their contact because we... that increases our yield. That if we tested them right away, the test could be negative, but they could still be infected. So we have to wait a while. But yeah, so these were people who were in quarantine, waiting, being observed to see if they developed signs of infection. And then two of them were picked up just by our regular medical care system when people with COVID-like illness get tested. So they were people who had symptoms, fairly mild symptoms actually, sore throat and nasal congestion. Many, many people are being tested for those conditions and testing negative in the county, but two of them tested positive. So those are our eight cases. None of them are linked to each other, with the exception of contacts are linked, of course. Philip. Yeah. So did you say that some of them were pre-procedure screenings, asymptomatic?
Yes.
Four of them, yeah. So
yes.
Have any of the contacts of those people tested positive?
No. No, we've had actually very low rates of the contacts we've tested testing positive, which is good, and not unusual. In studies on close contacts, the highest risk group is family members. And family members in different studies have ranged from about 5 to 15% become infected. So by no means the majority. And the largest studies are the ones that show that the household contact rate is 5% or less. So but still that's a significant risk, and we now have enough justification to essentially test all contacts. Now, a number of these cases, I got several questions from the KPTZ listeners about how does this actually work. When we get a case, the first thing we do is investigate that case. So we find out everything we can about that person's condition and where they've been and the timing of their illness, so we can figure out when they might have been infected and when they became contagious and who they might have spread it to. And that's called the case investigation. And then that leads us to the other phase, which is contact tracing. So after we've determined their infectious period and we've identified anyone who might have virtually all household members are contacts, but also we use the criteria that anyone who has had a face-to-face exposure for greater than 15 minutes and within that 6-foot physical space, that's a contact. And contacts get calls from us. We tell them they've been exposed. We don't reveal identities. We don't tell them who they've been exposed to. But we tell them they've been exposed. They need to be in quarantine for 14 days from their last exposure. And we ask them how we can help them to support them in that quarantine and whether they need any assistance. We stress to them the importance of it and that they'll need to be tested if they develop symptoms, or increasingly, we will test them at this 7-day time pose, and so that's kind of the way it works, and that's our this is a time honored communicable disease control kind of strategy, but to make it work. We need to have adequate testing, so we need to find cases, and we need the high levels of cooperation, which so far we've been getting, by and large. Cases have been staying in strict isolation. Contacts have been accepting the hardship of quarantine, knowing that they're protecting their friends and family and the community. But we're going to have to keep that up. And all of these people get daily calls. So all cases get daily calls. Contacts get daily calls. And that's a significant workload issue. As of Friday, we had 34 contacts that we were making daily calls for. And now that number has gone up because of the I don't even know the total number of contacts yet for the case that we picked up yesterday. But so that's basically how that system works. Any other questions about that I could answer before moving on about, you know, our current cases and how we manage them?
Okay.
Dr. Luck, I think you're going to answer this perhaps with the other KPDZ questions, but it's something I get a lot too is people wanting more information about each case. Can you talk a little bit about what is public and what is not, and why it's important to maintain that?
Sure. It's the category of health information we put this into. This is called notifiable condition information, and there are over 60 different notifiable conditions. In addition to COVID-19, you know, things like sexually transmitted infections and tuberculosis and a whole range of different diseases are notifiable to public health officials. So people that diagnose them have to report it to us. We contact everyone with a notifiable condition in order to prevent that disease from spreading to someone else. But we keep that information very strictly confidential, not only because that's the law, but because it also builds this kind of trusting relationship that we need to have. You know, people need to be honest with us and tell us things about their life and activities that are often very confidential. And you know, I think we earn that trust by strictly protecting the information. And this is something, you know, people often wonder, you know, well, how can you possibly inform contacts without revealing who the source is? And my response to that is, we are really good at this. We know all the tricks for doing that. Sometimes people can connect the dots. Sometimes it's impossible. If you have if you are told you have a sexually transmitted infection and you have one partner, it's hard not to connect the dots there. In the case of so I think it's important that we try to give as much information about COVID-19 and how it's spreading in our community as we can. So we'll try to do that while protecting confidentiality. One question I've gotten relative to this is, you know, what are the stores that are safe to go to or not safe to go to in the community? And so far, we've had no cases that are linked specifically to restaurants or grocery stores or public venues, which does not say 100% it hasn't happened. It's just in our investigations, we have not been able to find that, and we found other sources of the infection that are far more likely. Mostly trips to Seattle or out of the community, in some cases out-of-town visitors. So visitors from out of state, family members often, who've come in, and although they did not have symptoms, they still could be carrying the infection. We think up to 40% of people now who have this infection and can potentially spread it have no symptoms. And that leads to another question I got from KPTZ listeners is, why are we not doing universal testing? And I know that term sounds great, you know, why just can't we test everyone all the time? But you would literally have to do just that. You would have to test everyone every day or every week or every 2 weeks, whatever interval you chose. It would be a massive amount of tests and very low rates of disease being detected. You know, you would do potentially thousands of tests to just pick up a few people. So we have to be more targeted than that. But there is an interesting new idea, testing strategy that's being researched on along these lines, and it's what's called pool testing. And so you don't you take an entire organization, you get a nasal sample from everyone in that organization, and then you combine them all together and do a test on that pool of specimens. And if it tests negative, then you know that group is uninfected. And if it tests positive, then you have to do individual tests on everyone in that group to find out where the positive is. But this is we're researching this as a strategy now, but this is probably going to be a shape of things to come, that we will do pool testing in schools or in workplaces, correctional facilities, to try to find that needle in a haystack without having to expend the resources to do huge volumes of testing. Testing is not free. Although people are not being charged for it, it costs about $100 a test to actually do the test. So there's considerable expense involved. So I wanted to move on. There were some other questions about masking. And the trend here is there's very strong momentum now all around the country to promote and in many cases compel masking. 46 of 50 states now have some form of masking directive. 16 of those, including Washington State, have statewide sort of universal masking directives. And what's driving it is the recognition that both about asymptomatic transmission, but also that this is a very good method of source control. And you've heard me talk about that over and over again. But that's really what the science is showing. And we actually had some good news on face shields. Just this last week, there was a big JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, article on face shields. And as they tested them out, they are better than we were expecting, both in terms of source control. They reduce dispersion of particles and for protection. We use face shields in the hospital all the time in combination with masks. So the face shield plus mask is the best. But face shields alone are better than we thought. And face shields are being developed that have this kind of cloth collar along the bottom that collects secretions even better. So we may soon have some face shields that are at least getting closer to masks in terms of the desirable source control effect. Yes?
I was wondering if face shields satisfy qualify as a mask if we are seeing them as being more effective, if people have, you know, issues breathing or other objections to masks. Is it currently, could they wear a face shield in lieu of a mask and be compliant with the governor's order?
We talked about that on the health officer's call, and it's kind of a gray zone. They, you know, the order mostly says face coverings. So that's a pretty broad category. So masking is preferred, but yes, face shields are acceptable, and especially if they have something like along their bottom to collect secretions. And it can be something like a bandana or a kerchief or something down at the bottom of the neck. Essentially the face shield prevents particles from being expelled forward, but they're vented along the outsides of the mask. So you get more environmental contamination with a face shield. But they seem to be better than we thought in terms of preventing this face-to-face spread. So it's my understanding that does meet the criteria of the governor's order, even though masking is preferable and seems to be more effective. I know it's getting a little confusing to people what's going on here in Washington State, because there are really four different masking directives. Actually, three of them would apply in Jefferson County. So first of all, there's a worker mandate. This was enacted by the governor on June 8th and requires all employers and employees to wear masks indoors at all times, unless you're alone in an office, and outdoors, if you're working outdoors and you're not able to maintain a 6 foot or greater distance. And that's enforced by the occupational health and safety rules in labor and industry. And then in Yakima, and only in Yakima, the governor enacted an emergency declaration that said businesses are required to make sure that anyone coming into the business is wearing a mask or a face covering. It's sort of being called no mask, no service. So businesses are directed to deny service to people who are not wearing masks. They can provide that service in another way, home delivery or curbside delivery, but unmasked people are not allowed in indoor spaces in Yakima currently. And then there's a statewide directive that has widely been attributed to the governor, but it actually was issued by the Secretary of Health, Dr. John Weissman, and it's he's using the same authority that local health officers use for masking orders or masking directives, and that does have a penalty clause. It's a misdemeanor violation. But the state is not going to enforce that. The state patrol is not going to enforce it. It's up to local law enforcement, who are empowered to enforce statewide directives, to enforce that. And then finally, there's the directive that I issued in May that is does require not only businesses to wear masks indoors, but also businesses are to require people who come into their businesses to wear masks. And this is something, you know, I've not put a or we've not approached it as a misdemeanor, but it would not be hard to change that because if it was reframed as a health officer order, violation of it would become a misdemeanor violation. But as I've explained before, I'm really trying to resist doing this as a criminal justice type thing. This is something that we really have to do as a community. And people who are resistant to masking, they have to re-examine their positions. A lot of people have written to me trying to make these scientific arguments that masks don't work. They're relying on very old data or impossible standards. I've actually had people write and say that they will not wear masks until there's randomized controlled studies that prove that masks work, and they really haven't thought that through. It's kind of hard to do a blinded study of people with masks and not masks, and you somehow are not. They don't know, you don't know who's wearing a mask or not. Maybe you really do have to be blinded. You have to have your eyes closed at all times. That's just not how it works in health emergencies. If we waited until we had absolute proof of effectiveness for everything we do, we would be waiting forever. It takes years to do those kind of studies. We don't have years. We've got days or weeks in many cases to make decisions. People who are holdouts, you know, should read the writing on the wall. The tide has turned. This is the new standard. They will feel increasingly uncomfortable going into indoor spaces being unmasked, and they should feel uncomfortable. They're making other people uncomfortable because they're jeopardizing the health of other people. And that, I think it's that pressure that ultimately will turn the tide. I saw a recent study that it's now in the high 80% of Americans who are wearing masks. It's the overwhelming majority. And as Willie has reported, you know, some of our surveys in this area have shown that high a compliance as well. Commissioner Brotherton, did you?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to clarify one thing. I've had a few calls with concerned business owners about having to enforce masking directives on customers. And from your explanation today, it sounds like since we're not in Yakima, there isn't a lot of burden on business owners to, you know, no mask, no service. Like there's no penalty that's weighing on the shoulders of business owners to keep the unmasked out of their store. They can still ask them to leave, but they're not mandated to. Is that correct?
Exactly. They should ask them to do it. And we would never want them to force them to do it. But it is a reasonable thing. If they ask someone to wear a mask and that person refuses, they are authorized to exclude that person from their business. And cite as the authority the local health officer order that says this is a requirement of them. So we don't want people getting into altercations of this. We want people to do the right thing. And sometimes you have to ask people to do the right thing. And when you do, they will.
Sorry, I just wanted to follow up really quick. The ADA is pushing back against some of these cards that are being flaunched about on Facebook and everything, saying, "Oh, I have a disability, so I can't wear a mask," right? And that's not an ADA issue, correct?
Yeah, exactly. The ADA doesn't apply in a health emergency, and something there where the conventional wisdom on there's very few medical contraindications to mask use. That is to say, medical conditions that prevent you from wearing a mask. There's some psychological conditions that do, and some developmental disability conditions. So it's not as if 100% of people can wear masks, but people who have these fake cards off the internet that say, "I've got a condition and I don't have to tell you what it is," that's not how it works. And importantly, even people who have a valid medical reason not to wear a mask, that doesn't somehow make it safe for them to go unmasked into an indoor space. They could be carrying the infection. They are putting other people at risk. So my advice to people with a bona fide medical disability is that you need to make every effort to do what you need to do in ways other than going indoors. You know, having your groceries delivered, having a person without a medical disability do your shopping for you, have curbside service. There are alternatives. So just being exempt from the masking requirement doesn't exempt you from the laws of biology. You can still carry the infection and transmit it to others. Let me just comment a bit on phase three. Today is the day that we submit the application to Department of Health. When it will be processed and acted on is an open question. I know that Kitsap County submitted theirs on June 19th, and at least as of Saturday, had not heard from Department of Health. And I checked the web this morning. I didn't see any announcements that they'd been approved. So it's been about a week and a half that they have been waiting to hear from the state on their application. So it's certainly not 24-hour turnaround like it was with phase two. And it's possible that the state may deny or modify our phase three application. And if that's the case, we would look very intently at their reasons. And I'm not anticipating that, even with relative surge of new cases, we're still below that kind of cutoff Importantly, the increased cases we're seeing are not from outbreaks. They're not linked to community events. They're kind of random dispersed cases throughout the community. And it's to me, it says we're doing the kind of testing that we want to be doing. Because I think some people have believed that these very low case numbers means that the coronavirus just isn't in Jefferson County, and I have never believed that. It's been here since the very beginning. It's just this low-level smoldering kind of infection. The iceberg's always there. We just see the tip from time to time, and now we're getting better at finding those cases, and that's what we want to do, because that's we can't control something when we can't find it. And it's extremely difficult finding a disease where 40% of the people have no symptoms. Now, that is a supreme challenge. So the application's going in. People have asked me, well, should you delay it going in? And my response to that is that it's out of my hands right now, that the Board of Health, Board of Commissioners have acted on this. But it's important for people to realize that even if we do get phase three certification, we can at any time roll back specific measures. And probably the very first thing I would consider is bars, just because of our national data a trend I didn't talk about, but I think is very significant and worrisome, is the fastest growing age demographic for COVID-19 cases is in the 25 to 40-year-olds. And we've seen some large clusters. And in these states where, Texas especially, where we're seeing these rapid increases, the hospitals are filling up with young people. So these cases, people in their 30s and 40s are getting sick enough to be in hospitals. And it should remind people, nobody is immune to the complications of COVID-19. So we've got to do a lot better job of convincing young people, adolescents and young adults, that they are not immune to this. And even if they get it, whatever immunity they get may not be that long-lasting. It's playing a game of Russian roulette that you may have to play over and over again until we have a vaccine. If we need to, and it comes down to the health officer, as I'm understanding phase three, is the health officer can cancel any of the phase three or even phase two activities for that matter. There are things in phase three that I think are very low risk, like museums and libraries. And these are places that we can keep very safe. But there are risky new activities like bars and gatherings up to 50 people. And these, in order for people to do these, they have to be done safely. People have to wear masks, they have to maintain the physical distancing, and if they don't, we need to shut them down. We are not going to be like Arizona and Texas and allow things to spin out of control. If we see rates going up, if we see people not getting the memo, not doing things safely, we got to react to that. But that's not where we are right now. So bottom line, I'm not in favor of not going forward on phase three, but the only thing that will guarantee that we stay in phase three is how people behave and whether they adopt the behavioral changes that will keep us all safe or whether they fail to do so, as they've done in these states where it's spinning out of control. So it's kind of an... It's in the hands of all of us, really, not just public health or elected officials or governmental officials. It's going to come down to what we truly do as a community or fail to do. So in my final thing, we're really in our messaging, we're focusing now on four things. So masking, physical distancing, hand hygiene, and the whole thing about, you know, not touching your face, which is really about not putting contaminated hands in your eyes, nose, or mouth, or eating food with contaminated hands. But those are the four key strategies for preventing getting COVID-19.
Great.
And I think I've answered all the KPTZ questions.
I appreciate that. Kate, David, any more questions for you guys?
I'm curious how we want to handle talking about phase three. Is that something we're going to hear from Willie first and then go to phase three conversation?
I think maybe we should go all around. Since we have Vicky here too, I'd love to hear her thoughts about that as well. So maybe waiting on the conversation about whether we do modify what we've done, or I guess, I mean, do we have the capacity to change our up down into a down, I guess, right?
And then go back to Board of Health.
And it would have to go back to Board of Health, I think. Yeah. Is that your understanding, Dr. Locke?
That would be one way, especially if you wanted to... If you wanted to modify it, yes, it would have to go back to Board of Health. If you know, as commissioners, if you wanted to stop it, if you withdrew your approval, that would essentially stop. You could direct Vicky not to submit the application.
Gotcha. Go ahead, Phil. You're muted, Phil.
Couldn't they also delay the application?
Yes. I would think so.
Okay, great. Well, with that, we'll hold off on the conversation, but if there's any questions going once, going twice, all right, well, we might come back, so stick around, but we'll pass it off to Willie for the Department of Emergency Management update.
Yeah, so the bulk of our cloth masks from the state EOC have been now distributed to partner agencies to hand out to low-income Washingtonians. We still have some held in reserve here at DEM by our logistics section to kind of monitor where masks are going a little bit faster to be able to support some of those agencies who might be making more contact than they initially thought. And then again, I'll make the offer, if you don't have anywhere else to go and you want two cloth masks, you can always contact us at DEM and we will make sure that you get the hookup there. We are currently waiting on two pieces of information about some additional specific types of masks from the state EOC. One is are the masks with the kind of clear shield over the mouth so you can see the person, either read their lips, see their facial expressions, that kind of thing. Those are folks have suggested full face shields as an alternative to those, but the full face shields are a little bit bulkier, a little bit more cumbersome, so there's been actually a surprising amount of interest in those clear paneled masks. We're awaiting a decision from the state EOC's unified command, so the leadership within the EOC, as to whether or not they'll be supporting local jurisdictions with those types of masks or if we'll be on our own. So we should be hearing shortly. We thought we'd hear late last week on those, but that decision's been a little bit delayed. So as soon as we find out, hopefully the state will be supporting us with some of those. If not, we'll look at sourcing some ourselves to provide to some of our partners who asked specifically about those. So I'm still TBD on those specific types of masks. The other question we got as we started distributing these masks to some of the low-income residents of Jefferson County was specifically masks for children. These were all kind of a one-size-fit-all adult masks. And, you know, the governor's or Secretary Wiesman's recent masking order, you know, allows for a waiver for children under five, don't have to wear a mask. But masks ages 3 to 5 are still encouraged. And so a lot of folks were asking, well, you're giving, you know, adult-sized masks. What about masks for children? The state is currently working on sourcing a bulk order for distribution statewide for masks for children. So we're right now this week we'll be submitting with our regular PPE order a rough estimate of the amount of masks we'll need for Jefferson County's younger population to be able to get some masks out for the youth. So again, I should have some more information and a timeline for those specific masks during my briefing next week. So more information to follow there. Other than that, again, our masking program, distribution program continues to go fairly well. We're going to be looking for a second round of masks to distribution to businesses through the chamber. The feedback on that has been pretty positive thus far. It's been nice for businesses to have masks to hand folks if they walk in without one. It eases some of the strain that Dr. Locke previously referenced and, again, ups our compliance. And then our community mask program continues to chug along. I had mentioned a couple weeks ago, it started to peter out a little bit, but again, with the masking orders, our community mask makers have stepped back up and have continued to donate masks, and those continue to get distributed as well. So again, plenty of masks available. Not having one isn't an excuse. Again, contact DEM directly. If you have no other options, again, we'll be more than happy to help you out. Other than that, with regards to PPE, and our first responders, our healthcare, we continue to have adequate supplies for any additional surge. I know that's been kind of a concern as we move into to phase three. They continue to have plenty of stock on hand for 14 days, 21 plus days, et cetera. The one thing I will note is that the patient census, the bed census at Jefferson Healthcare, as well as other hospitals throughout the state, has increased. As we initially, in March, were preparing for an initial surge, patient census was almost zero. Everyone was staying home. Elective procedures were being put off. And, there were almost next to no one in hospitals other than COVID patients or otherwise very life-threatening type things. As elective procedures have come back online, people have started, moving about. Bad things have been happening, et cetera. The patient census has risen a little bit, so there are less beds available, especially after some outbreaks on the east side of the state where patients have been transferred west. However, locally, Jefferson Healthcare does have an excellent plan to be able to expand bed capacity. If we do have a second surge, our DEM logistics section has 25 beds held in storage for them to be able to use. So that's not a major concern for me either. I still feel that we'll be able to have adequate PPE and healthcare capacity locally, and just wanted to address that. That's basically, and I will mention our kind of masking compliance report. Our planning section team noticed a kind of a slight dip in masking compliance just before Secretary Wiesman's order went into place. Some of our preliminary surveys over the weekend noted an additional increase in compliance, specifically in some of the hot spots I had mentioned before where compliance hovered. It really lagged behind places like the grocery store where we were saying 80 to 90% folks in masks. So we saw a solid initial bump over the course of the weekend and really want to continue to see that masking compliance hold steady. We really want to see 90%+. We are seeing that in some places. Although I will mention, of course, your mileage may vary. I've had some folks write in saying, well, I was at this store or that store, and it was less than what you said. And we understand this is a little bit unscientific, but we are seeing some pretty good masking compliance out there. The one issue I do want to address that our folks have been saying is the mask is supposed to go over your mouth and your nose. They've noted that at any particular grocery store, you'll see anywhere from 5 to 20% of the people who are wearing masks who have a mask on their head somehow, but it'll be down by their chin and their mouth and nose are actually fully exposed, which defeats the purpose entirely. Or it'll have sagged below their nose so their nostrils are exposed and it's just covering their mouth. Or they'll have the mask just kind of hanging around their neck, et cetera. So if you have a mask, cover your mouth and your nose pretty.
We lost you for a second, Willie. Sorry, continue. The last thing we heard was pretty please. Looks like we lost him. Well, it's nice that he ended lightly.
Yeah.
This is KPTZ, Port Townsend, and we've just heard the weekly public health updates on COVID-19 live from the Jefferson County Board of County Commissioners meeting at the courthouse. This is important here. The recording of today's reports will be available later today for streaming online at kptz.org. And again, thanks for listening. This is John Trethewey. I'll see you next Monday. Thanks again, everyone.